Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're going to look today at a development from our theme last week, which was overwhelmingly on the English side of British politics, because one needs to bear in mind that Britain was, in the jargon of our days, a multiple polity, which means, in essence, a state which was really an amalgam of several states. And in fact, there were three states in question: England and Wales, which was one state, Scotland, which joined it as a result of one act of union, and Ireland, which joined as a result of another act of union. So it was a kind of an amalgamation that in some respects was different to that that was standard in Europe, in that the initial, logic might well be dynastic, same ruler on each of the crowns, but the fact of the matter was that this was a merger of governmental systems and political representation to create a parliament which can really truly be regarded as an imperial parliament, and that process was established by acts of parliament. So that's rather different than simply an amalgamation through dynastic means, as when Castile and Aragon came to form Spain. There was, though, it might be argued, and I think today Scottish nationalists or Irish nationalists might argue, a more similar pattern to the continent, in that obviously military means played a role, to wit, the ability of the British state to defeat uprisings in the 18th century. Now, I think one has to be careful here, because it's not a case of Scotland versus England when you're looking at Jacobitism, nor is it a case of Ireland versus Britain when one's looking at the Irish Rising in 1798, or for that matter, the Williamite conquest of Ireland in the early 1690s. In practical terms, what one has got in both episodes are civil wars within the area in question, Scotland and then Ireland, but also one has got a more broad civil war within the British Isles as a whole. And that, in a sense, looks back to the degree to which, in functional political terms and functional religious terms, in other words, in real terms as opposed to in constitutional terms, there already was a British state from the 16th century. This was a state which had not yet got a constitutional formulation in terms of what's to come, but it's a state in the sense that it was very hard in one part of the constituent British Isles to conceive of a religious or political situation, and rather one should merge the two, that was at variance with the other parts. And instead of which, there was a sense that wherever one was at was, in a sense, incomplete unless the other constituent parts of the British Isles could be brought into play. Now, you might suggest that this had, in fact, had medieval origins. After all, there were elements of the same in the power politics engrossing Scotland, Ireland, and England, Wales in the medieval period, whether one's thinking of episodes such as the Scottish War of Independence, which again was a Scottish civil war, of course, whether one's thinking of the process of conquest of Ireland, whether the ones thinking of the Wars of the Roses in England and Wales, which were part, in many senses, of a broader struggle. But there is the added dynamic to this in the 16th century, offered by the impact of the Protestant Reformation, and then linked to that, the extent to which the Protestant Reformation was not a complete success, notably so in Ireland, and linked to the latter, the strength of the Catholic Counter-Reformation, or some Catholics would argue they would call it simply the Catholic Reformation. And then Added to that, as another dimension, one has, of course, dynastic elements, particularly the exhaustion of the Tudor line in 1603 and the implications, therefore, of a Stuart takeover, which also was a Stuart takeover of the position of the Crown of England in Ireland. And then on top of that, one has the geopolitics in which France in particular, but other great powers, vie for influence in the British Isles or seek to weaken the London-based state by encouraging dissidents in the British Isles. And that is a theme that you can take forward from, for example, the crisis of the 12 teens, when French forces were deployed in England against King John. One could take it forward to the congruence of Scottish and French opposition to Edward I in the 1290s. And obviously it flows through into Jacobitism. And if one wished to be facetious, I do not think the observation is tremendously helpful, but one could note elements in the 20th century, for example, German support, German armed support in the sense of arms supplying to Irish dissidents at the background of the Easter Rising of 1916, which of course was foremost an episode in World War One, although it's now presented very much as an episode of Irish nationalism, and then again to the support of from Eastern Bloc powers for the Provisional IRA. Now, let us, as it were, try and wind down the telescope a little and concentrate more on the situation that begins, if you like, with the Glorious Revolution, so-called, of 1688 to 89, because this led to the overthrow of James II, James VII of Scotland, not just in England, Wales, but also in Scotland and subsequently in Ireland. And the result of that was to create a new state, which on the one hand, you could argue, saw English dominance of the British Isles, but you could also argue that it was a domination that was helped by, shared with, and in important respects, shaped by significant sections of the Irish and Scottish population, particularly both Irish Episcopalians and, more significantly, Scottish Presbyterians. Now, the alternative had been glimpsed in 1689 when James II's Parliament in Dublin had rejected much of the authority of the Westminster Parliament, but that path had been blocked. So what one can see working through from 1688 to 89, from the narrative of, shall we say, a John Preble producing a nationalist account of Culloden in the film of that name, is of English dominance. But actually, that was a very crude and silly view, because the reality was that the British state, as with any state, was a cooperative system in which there were, as I've indicated, significant local stakeholders. And in particular terms, although Scottish politics was about more than the tension between Presbyterian and Episcopalian, nevertheless, that was a key element. And William III, by allying with the Presbyterians, essentially, or if you wish to look at it differently, by allowing his Scottish policy to be perforce shaped by them, created a political system in Scotland in which the Presbyterian interests, both aristocratic and urban oligarchic, enjoyed far more success, far more stability than had been their case under the Stuarts. While conversely, the Episcopalians, who had seen favour from the Stuarts, found their position and their numerical weight attenuated. So that in a sense, when one talks about a new order to the Scottish system, you could argue, of course, in terms of oppression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the oppression, if you wish to use those terms, is coming really more from Edinburgh or Edinburgh and Glasgow influences in London than it is coming from a group of ministers of English origins in London, most of whom knew absolutely nothing about Scotland. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that, of course, no ruler of Britain in the 18th century visited Scotland, Wales, or Ireland, nor did they go to such remote, of course, English cities as York or Manchester, Birmingham or Chester or Truro. So that it's worth bearing in, and the same would be true of the majority of the aristocrats. Ironically, but maybe not surprisingly, the member of the royal family who was best travelled was George II's second son, William Duke of Cumberland, who was really quite irritated to have to campaign in Scotland in 1746, because he saw his true role as trying to resist the French in what they called the Austrian Netherlands and we would call Belgium. Anyway, partly because of a lack of knowledge, partly because of a lack of interest, partly because of the necessity of relying on one's local allies, Scotland is in essence left to the Scots. And they don't do a bad job of it. Scotland, which in the early decades of the 18th century, the last decades of the 17th century, had been an economic, pretty much a basket case, particularly in the 1690s, the unfortunate colonial enterprise in the Darien expedition, and just the extent to which there was only limited growth in the Scottish economy, and Scotland was far poorer in agricultural terms, was replaced in the 18th century, particularly the second half of the 18th century, by far more economic stimulus and growth, and the sort of industrialization that visitors such as Tobias Smollett, a Scotsman who went back to visit Scotland, or indeed Samuel Johnson, very much an Englishman, noted. And although Scotland didn't make such significant advances in agriculture as it did in manufacturing, and although the canal system was not brilliantly developed there, nevertheless, in economic terms, the 18th century was a success for Scotland, and Scots also benefited greatly, both as individuals and as an economy, particularly the Glasgow-based West of Scotland economy, from the imperial links of the British Empire. And it is dubious, well, in fact, it's inconceivable, that Scotland would have been able to create such an empire on its own. So I think that that is all a significant point. I think it's fair to say the story is less happy as far as Ireland is concerned, but nevertheless, there was in Ireland in the 18th century a significant amount of economic growth, particularly in agriculture. The agricultural produce, and we've mentioned Empire, for example, a standard place in which British warships took on their food was Cork. And in many senses, the Irish beef industry, for example, was an adjunct of the British Empire. And I think it's also fair to say that the degree of tension and at times oppression, which one can associate with the Williamite conquest and its aftermath, was progressively attenuated during the 18th century. And in essence, prior to the revolutionary crisis of the 1790s, produces a considerable amount of radicalization, initially among Ulster Presbyterians, subsequently among some Southern Irish and East of Ireland Catholics. Prior to that, the situation was not doing too badly. So that's one way to look at, an important way, I would argue, to look at the British state is from its imperial dimension. And a number of scholars have done that. Linda Colley, in her book Britons, very much argued that a shared Protestantism and a shared commitment to empire was important in the knitting together of much of the society of the constituent parts of the British Isles. Not just elites in the sense of, you know, five men and the Duke of Newcastle, but a broad pattern of engagement through the economy, through a public culture of an accountable parliamentary government, plus elections, plus the press, which created not a democracy, a lot of people couldn't vote, including women, of course, but created what was, by the standards of the age, a very broadly based elite, if you wish to use that term, or system. So that's one thing we could say. I then want to say a bit about the extension of that model to the empire beyond the seas, as it were. But let's first hear the observations and comments on that of Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. We can look at this two ways, can't we? We can look at the effect that the integration of Scotland and Ireland had upon British politics, particularly on the English, you know, to how the Scots and the Irish changed English politics, or we can look at it, you know, how London changed the politics of Ireland and Scotland. I wonder just to start with perceptions in London as to how Irish and Scottish politics affected British politics as a whole. Is there in London a kind of Whig propaganda that actually the Scots, I'm talking the period after the Glorious Revolution, the Scots are really Jacobites pining for their you know, Scottish dynasty, or is it actually the reverse, in that those Scots who are politically active tend to be quite strongly Whigs themselves, certainly against the Catholicism of the Jacobites, and likewise Ireland. So it's a question not just about reality, but about perception.
Yes, I think reality and perception, that interplay is always significant. I mean, first of all, I think as far as Scotland is concerned, there is an enormous shock to the system vis-a-vis Scotland in 1745, when December the 4th, Bonnie Prince Charlie reaches Derby. And in a way, that looks back to the 17th century. The arrival of Scottish troops in England had been very important in the later stages of the First English Civil War. It had been an element, though, of course, they get defeated in the Second English Civil War, the Battle of Preston in 1648. It had been an element in General Monk marching south with the troops from Scotland, though, of course, they were essentially English troops in 1660. There is this sense that Scotland is a volatile part of the situation. And one of the reasons in England for support for the Union was the argument, the very strong argument, that this meant that when Queen Anne died, there was not going to be the risk of a different monarch coming to the throne from the Scottish Parliament as opposed to the Westminster Parliament, and or the Scottish Parliament taking steps in foreign policy that were unacceptable to its London counterpart. And the latter was particularly consequential in 1706, 1707, 1708, because those years were years of hard fighting against the French in the Low Countries, and also of a French invasion attempt on the east coast of Scotland, with the French fleet, which got out of Dunkirk, evaded the English pursuers, and which had on board none other than James III, so-called James III and VIII. So I think it's fair to say that there is, on the one hand, in the early 18th century, a security concern about Scotland. Now, we've got to put this in its perspective. One of the great problems with history and people writing about history and talking about history is they select their evidence. So, you know, I, as a professional historian of long standing, could easily provide you with a whole host of quotes arguing that for the British state in that period, the absolutely foremost issue was trying to control Scotland. Well, actually, no. On the whole, for the British state, there was far more concern about France, and understandably so. There were French invasion attempts of England in 1690-1692, a big one in 1744, and those are a big one in 1759. Those are only the biggies. There are also smaller ones that one is talking about. So I think one needs to be aware that you have to put this in its context. Often commanders, most famously Field Marshal Wade, George Wade, was sent up to, as it were, look after the Scotland station with relatively little interest then in London as to what he was doing. And, you know, you can write a narrative around the building of roads and fortresses in this period. And again, I could do that easily for you. But in practical terms, it is not foremost in the attention of the British state. After the security crisis of the mid-18th century ends, and I've written a book called the mid-18th century crisis, after that ends, attitudes towards Scotland are much more sanguine. There is concern in the 1790s that Scotland shows, or certain Scottish circles show, more pro-French revolutionary radical sentiment than is the norm in England. But there's also plenty of concern about the situation in England, including in London itself. And on the whole, attitudes are fairly sanguine. Scotland is seen as a support to the empire. Scotland is seen as a major support for, in industrial terms. The Scots are overrepresented both in the membership of the army as soldiers, but also as officers. So I would say that Scotland is not a matter of great anxiety in the late 18th century. Interestingly enough, Ireland, which might have been an area of greater anxiety, Ireland had not risen during the 15, the Scottish Jacobite Rising in Scotland and Northern England in 1715 and to 16, nor did it rise in the 45, the rising of, again, in Scotland and Northern England in 1745 to 46. And on the whole was quiescent, although there were anxieties. The Duke of Bedford, fourth Duke of Bedford's correspondence, he was the senior British minister in Dublin, indicates some anxiety. But really, it was quiet during the mid-18th century crisis. So Ireland, again, is not a matter of significant anxiety. There's much more anxiety about Ireland in the 19th century, in an age of nationalism, than there is in the 18th century. And attempts by some commentators today to go for a sort of longevity of Irish nationalism really, I think, are in difficulties for the 18th century. And I would say the same for Scotland. Obviously, you can see Scottish sentiment expressed, and Murray Pittock has done very well at unearthing that, and you can see criticism of links with London. But to be blunt, it is far less than you would get from Ireland in the 19th century.
So I want to ask you to reflect on different ways in which power was exercised in Ireland and Scotland. And of course, during the course of the 18th century, particularly in Ireland, the answer changes somewhat. But in Dublin, there's the whole kind of Dublin Castle, almost like a kind of viceregal element asserting the British or the Anglo-Irish ascendancy. Scotland doesn't have a structure like that. Should we talk more in terms of kind of informal, almost like party managers up there who are in an eminence grease kind of way running the show? Really, in the case of Scotland, is it almost like we can debate whether it's benign, but a form of neglect in which Scotland was just left to get on without formal structures as such, you know, with its MPs its select number of peers down in London.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, there are, in effect, key managers, I would say. I would say the Earl of Islay, the third Duke of Argyll, and prior to that, the second Duke, before he fell out with his counterparts, are key managers. And obviously, towards the end of the century, Henry Dundas. So I would say that, and the other thing I would argue is it worked quite well for Scotland. There was, for a while, a Secretary of State for Scotland, and you know, that fell victim to rows between ministers. I mean, the last Secretary of State, who was a Scot, was an ally of John Lord Carteret's. When Carteret was replaced by the Pelhams, than Tweeddale went. I don't think Scotland suffered from not having one of its aristocrats as a Secretary of State. In fact, I'd say the exact opposite. What that meant is that pretty well everybody in Scotland could make their representations more widely. And of course, you do get in the person, interestingly enough, of Bute in 1762, actually a Scot as chief minister. I mean, not as much, of course, as you were to get in the 19th century and early 20th century, but I don't think there's any real sense of Scotland as a colony, and I think anybody that tries to suggest that to you is foolish. The Scots who do badly in the 18th century are the Episcopalians. They suffer, if you like, there is a Presbyterian aristocratic ascendancy. The Catholics are quite marginal. They're quite a small group. And also, of course, there's population growth in the late 18th century. And what that does is encourages a lot of people to emigrate, particularly to the expanding opportunities as they appear, and indeed as they are, of the North American colonies.
And in Ireland, though, you would contrast that as it's a much more formal structure of authority in Dublin than it is in Edinburgh.
Yes, I think that I would say you've got it in one there. Because again, that's what Ireland wanted. In the sense, I say that's a ridiculous phrase. That's what the politicians wanted. They wanted their own parliament. And the preservation of a parliament in Dublin for most of the century until the Act of Union of 1800 enabled the Ireland's Protestant politicians to retain a measure of importance and independence, rather like, you might say, the DUP or the Ulster Unionist politicians before that. So what you had is you had what were known as Irish undertakers. That was the phrase they were used. Undertakers, not in the sense they buried anybody, but that they were the key politicians in the Dublin Parliament. And they sort of, as it were, wielded government patronage in order to get business through Parliament. The Lord Lieutenant of Ireland in 1755, I've got this quote, William Marquess of Hartington, about to be the Duke of Devonshire, and he says, "This country is divided," means Ireland, "is divided into two parties, both party near equal, each struggling for the superiority." There's no strength sense that he has, that he just, you know, blows a whistle and people line up and say, "Yes, sir." That is certainly not the sense. In fact, on the whole, British Lord Lieutenants complained bitterly about their lack of influence in Ireland.
And how powerful was the Irish Parliament in the 18th century? What were the limits on its authority?
Oh, well, that's a extremely good question. As you will know, the Westminster Parliament passed a declaratory act in 1720, which stated its supremacy over that of Dublin. And there's no doubt that in British terms, Dublin suffered from the extent to which it wanted to export into a market, the British market, in the sense of England, Wales and Scotland, where it didn't have as much traction by any means as it would like. So yes, I would say that is a real problem. But you've got to distinguish, of course, a more serious point, which is what are you actually saying when you're talking about representation? If you're talking about the average Irish person, however you measure average, of course, the majority of those were Catholic or Presbyterian, Presbyterian in Ulster, and they're not really represented in a political system which is dominated by Episcopalians, or we would call them Anglicans. So there is a more profound problem with the Irish system than that of the actual influence of its parliament.
One of the things we won't talk about the 19th century today, but obviously when the Irish parliament is abolished, you get the Irish MPs in Westminster in the 19th century, and particularly as the century goes on, they become a much more cohesive Irish nationalist group with an agenda. In the 18th century, the Scottish MPs in Westminster, is there like a block of Scottish MPs that argue a Scottish position, or are they just Whigs and Tories arguing Whig and Tory points who just happen to come from Scotland, but there's nothing discernibly Scottish about the angle they take?
Well, there are factions within the Scottish representatives in London, in Westminster. Those factions tend to correspond to divisions in Scottish politics, which are partly a matter of patronage, partly a matter of place, partly a matter of aristocratic lineage. I would say that they don't really align with the Whigs and Tories. Nobody wants to align with the Tories because the Scots are overwhelmingly Presbyterian and the Tories are overwhelmingly the higher side of Anglican. And also because the Tories are in opposition under G1 and G2. You want to align with success. But the point is that Whig politics, Whig politicians are split. I mean, there's the first famous Whig split of 1717. That really comes to an end in 1720. There's a small Whig opposition in the early 20s. But then there's another Whig split in 1725, which goes on really till the broad-bottomed administration of the mid-1740s. It then resumes in 1747, etc. So the Whigs are split. And what that means is that Whig leaders, if you wish to use that term, there is no constituted political party. What that means is that Whig leaders look for Scottish assistance in terms of building up the number of votes. And Scottish MPs and their aristocrats look to align with those Whigs they think are going to succeed. So Islay, who I mentioned earlier, Third Argyll, if you like, is a key ally of the Pelhams, whereas his brother, the second Duke, who had been sort of a government loyalist, had fallen out with the Pelhams. The first Duke plays a role in the background to the Whig split. And then if you go forward, of course, Dundas is a key ally of William Pitt the Younger. So I wouldn't see it necessarily as Scots competing as a Scottish lobby. I would see a much more sophisticated system in which there's an interaction whilst everybody at the same time is trying to pursue their interest, their vision of politics. There isn't the equivalent of the modern party list. There isn't the equivalent of an SNP, which is an aspect of a modern politics in which you're running a mass organization in order to exploit and benefit from, and if you like, serve a universal franchise. Well, that's not the situation in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, the franchise in Scotland was tiny. I forget the figure, but we're really talking only a few thousand electors in the whole country.
The franchise is small, and also it's worth bearing in mind separately, as you know, Not all the peers sit in the House of Lords. They pick, they elect what they call their representative peers, which is interesting, incidentally, because in a way it's a model for what happened to the House of Lords in the 1990s. But no, you're right. Nobody would argue that Scotland led the way in democracy in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. Although it led the way in some of the Enlightenment ideas. So it's an interesting point, one we must stop, I'm afraid, because we're out of time, despite this really fascinating conversation about what Ireland and Scotland brought to England and vice versa. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And people might find my, I think I can't remember what it's called, 18th Century Britain, of interest in this context.
I'm sure they will. Thank you very much indeed.